Is there a war coming, and will it be over worldview? Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principle Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
Great to be back with you, Barry. It's good to be here in my studio and you in yours, coming to you by the magic of Skype. We'll see how well our connection holds up, and we're confident in it after a few weeks.
Oh, that's true. You know, Chuck, there's an awful lot that's been going on lately around us, and honestly, the vast majority of it has very little to do with many of the topics we've been talking about before, which, you know, is basically the presidential debates and who's in and who's out. Although we do have a quick update on that. It looks like Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal has officially suspended his campaign for the Republican nomination. So that's one more down in the Republican Party. And wondering to find out how many more are coming before we get to filing deadlines in the middle of December, which is where the early state filing deadlines happen to land. Although, you know, New Hampshire and Iowa are going to start in January, and many of those have already been filed. So,
well, Barry, you know, we talked about the Democratic debate not too long ago. And one of the things I mentioned on our website, www.principledpolicy.com, that's principledpolicy.com, for those of you who wouldn't mind taking a look at some of this and maybe seeing one of our old podcasts, I made the comment that we were taking aim at a moving target, meaning the Democratic field. And by a moving target, I mean people keep coming and going. And right now, people are dropping out right and left. I would suppose you would say mostly right, depending on, yes, on your view of the political situation, that people are dropping out from the Republican race, making it seem as if that also is a moving target. Because a lot of the people we talked about when we did our program called How Many Republican Presidential Candidates Did You Say There Were? And we did two of those shows, so we can get through all 33 candidates at the time. And I think at this point we're down to, what, about 31 or 30?
Possibly, although many of the third-tier candidates that we talked about may or may not actually file in any of the states, even maybe their home states, because of just, you know, lack of wanting to keep moving forward with that. So it's hard to say, but you know, on the main stages, as we talk about, you know, you're still looking at about 12 or 13 different candidates that are still, at least in their own minds, believe they're viable.
Well, I've got to wonder, Barry, when Rick Santorum, Mike Huckabee, who else was on the undercard?
George Pataki, Lindsey Graham.
Lindsey Graham.
Oh, and Chris Christie.
And Chris Christie, and there was one who
Jim Gilmore.
Jim Gilmore.
Yes.
When they're going to drop?
Well, I'm not sure if Gilmore has ever actually been recognized or identified as really being in it other than in his own mind. Graham and Pataki, I just saw a recent poll coming out of New Hampshire where neither one of them actually broke the radar screen to even get votes. So, you know, your situation is that they're not getting traction, and my guess is that you're going to hear, at least probably from Lindsey Graham and maybe from Pataki too, the announcement of a new book coming here soon, because I think that may have been what their presidential aspirations were all about, were for the marketing prequel to launching some kind of a book.
Well, look, I've seen Mike Huckabee out there making a lot of noise, attempting to be aggressive. They're all trying to follow Donald Trump's lead at this point, because they've suddenly discovered that, yes, the Republican base really does want a candidate who will not take the kind of flack that everybody's kind of rolled over and taken in all the presidential campaigns in the immediate past. I've been voting since 1976 in presidential elections, and it's always been a case where everybody was so afraid of being bitten by the media dog that the first time some accusation comes up or the press spins something as some kind of an advantage for the left-wing candidate, that the Republican immediately rolls over and says, well, oh gosh, that's really what I meant. I didn't really mean to say that. I meant to say this. And they look weak. And the reason they look weak is because they're weak.
Yes, that's true.
Because ideologically, they really are almost as leftist as the leftist candidate. However, they can't make it look that way to the base, especially in the primary season. As we all know, in a primary, you have to run towards your base, and the base is conservative on the Republican side. In the general, you have to run toward the middle. As much as I hate to admit that, those are the facts. And another fact is that if you look at what you would call, quote-unquote, the extreme positions on the Republican side versus the Democratic side, you begin to see how big a gap is beginning to grow between the two sides. And honestly, I don't think there are enough independent voters to fill the gap. As I've stated before in some of our shows, we're more divided now than we have been since around 1860. And I think we all know what happened in 1860. And we've also talked about the fact that this election cycle looks an awful lot like 1968 with campus violence and all this revolutionary stuff going on in Europe. When I say revolutionary, I mean Islamic revolution. It was a little different kind of revolution in the 60s, but not really. The tactics are the same. So people think this is an unprecedented thing. Take it from us who've been around the block. This looks an awful lot like other election cycles.
It does, indeed, and that's really, I think, going to be the grand disappointment for many, especially those who are conservative in the Tea Party movement, because, you know, as you and I were talking earlier, and we did an interview for or the radio station earlier talking about it, and that was the idea that, you know, Donald Trump being in the lead right now and so many, you know, Tea Party type or conservatives or otherwise non-affected voters in the past are suddenly finding that Donald Trump seems to be attractive to them, and that shows that he's leading in all the polls and still is leading in all the polls. But really, you're right. What it gets down to is this election cycle is going to be very similar to every other election cycle. We just may have a little bit of external excitement thrown in with the unrest that's going on. Now we add in the mix of I think the double issue that we have of both Syrian refugees pouring into the United States via the Obama administration's policies, and also with the attacks that have happened overseas, the most recent one being in Paris, of course, and then, of course, you had a Beirut bombing. There was just a bombing that happened, I believe, in Nigeria that was also a suicide bomber. And with threats from the Islamic State group, basically now directly targeting or directly threatening to target American locations, including New York City, I think what you're going to end up having as we go through this cycle is a grand polarization, which I think is going to happen sooner rather than later on these very difficult issues. But then you're going to have massive unrest leading into the summertime, i.e., you mentioned 1968, and we know what happened with the riots outside the conventions and things of that nature. And I see that very much could be the political drama that plays out during this election cycle.
Well, look, 68 was called the long, hot summer. And there's a reason for that. There was a presidential campaign going on, and it got nasty. It was Humphrey versus Nixon. Vice President Hubert Humphrey, former senator from Minnesota, versus Richard Nixon, with George Wallace thrown in the mix. My parents were in Cleveland during the Cleveland riot in 1968, where basically Euclid Avenue burned. So I'm intimately familiar with what happened during the 60s. This looks an awful lot like it. People, you can have a strong emotional thing with people. I honestly think one of the reasons that Richard Nixon won, because he talked about being tough on the rioters. This is the kind of thing that you're going to see in the upcoming campaign. You know, we're seeing, I have to laugh about people who are taking over university president's office, just like in the mid-1960s, just like in 1968, and demanding that the name of programs be changed. The one I laughed about was that in Woodrow Wilson was president of an Ivy League school, and I can't remember which one. I think Princeton. And in Princeton, they took over the president's office and demanded that hyper-progressive Woodrow Wilson's name be taken off the school because he was, quote-unquote, a racist. Apparently, you know, racism is the worst possible thing that you can possibly be. Look, almost everybody was a racist when Woodrow Wilson was president of Princeton. This is a fact of life. There was a rather strange idea that races were more or less advanced. And part of that had to do with the fact that people had bought into the evolutionary idea that the races were at different levels of development and all that stuff. Well, that's, you know, complete nonsense. All you got to do is look at a Ben Carson to know that there are plenty of people with plenty of brains in every race. And they can be disparaging of Carson's medical capabilities as they want on the left. The fact is, the guy was a brain surgeon. You don't get there by being a dummy. So that being said, what we're seeing is these attempts to and the difference now and then is that at that time it was a battle between what you would say in broad terms, progressives versus conservatives. Now it's a battle of how far progressives versus progressives, because if you look at the university presidents that are being forced to resign and chancellors that are being forced to resign, these guys are not conservative by any stretch of the imagination. Yeah. So essentially progressives are eating their own, which as far as I'm concerned, isn't a bad thing. Good. Let them clean out their ranks from within. What we're seeing is the consequences of pushing the agendas that these guys have been pushing now for 50 and 60 years. We're seeing the chickens coming home to roost, and what they're getting is their own destruction by their own hand. They've committed cultural suicide, and it's just becoming evident to them. It's been evident to us that this was going to happen for how long, Barry? How long has people like and people we've been reading been talking about this cultural suicide that was coming?
For a very long time. You know what? You cannot hold two diametrically opposed viewpoints at the same time. And that's kind of what our culture is doing right now. We're either a culture who believes in God, who follows his word, and who seeks his blessings, or we're a culture that rejects God, elevates ourselves as gods, and will incur the curses and the wrath that he's promised to those who reject him. But our culture's tried to have both ways. They've tried to have, well, we want God's blessings, but we want to be our own gods. And so now we're seeing, I think, the tension of those two opposing viewpoints pushed to their I think they're stretching the end of their stretching point right now, and something's got to give, Chuck. And that's usually when a culture or a society decides it's going to either have a renaissance and a reformation and a rebirth, and comes into a golden age, or it's going to go on the dustbin of history. Because if you turn away from God and you reject him, you know, he will reject you as well. And so that's what we're facing right now. And so for those who you know, go pshaw at the idea of the fact that the American Republic was formed upon the basis of Christian principles and biblical standards of morality, of interaction, of social culture. I think many of them are going to start feeling and have started to feel the effects of trying to be, as Scripture says, having no king in Israel and every man doing what is right in his own eyes.
Yeah, exactly. It breaks down into an anarchy, and what if all you have to do is read the Book of Judges, And what you can see is the result of that particular form of anarchy. It didn't work, and it can't work. There's a difference between a republic under law and a republic under the law of the individual.
Mm-hmm, true.
And you know, our friends in the libertarian camp are all about the law of the individual. They're all about this idea that government isn't necessary, and that it automatically tends towards totalitarianism and all that stuff. And to that I would say, yes, it does tend to totalitarianism because of human nature, which unfortunately our friends in the libertarian camp deny the idea that human nature is flawed and corrupt. At least some of them do, not all of them. I'm a big fan of Dr. Tom Woods, and he is a Latin Mass Catholic, and I think you would find that he would agree that the human nature is flawed and corrupt at its base.
Mm-hmm.
But yes. There are a lot of people in the fringes of the libertarian movement who would tell you that our imperfections can be perfected by no one other than us. Well, Barry, we have to be involved in our ongoing efforts to achieve perfection, but we can't do it in this particular envelope, our physical form, and we can't do it without the Holy Spirit, Jesus Christ, and the Father. I mean,
I believe the theological term that we're talking about is called sanctification.
Exactly.
Where we try to draw, we are drawn closer and closer to the Father through Christ and through the Holy Spirit, and through our following the directions that God has placed in His Word for how we then should live our lives. And it's when that we decide that, well, we don't like that. That's too restricting. That's too narrow. Oh, I think I've got a better idea. Oh, you know what? You know, it would be so much nicer if I could do X, that we get into trouble. Because, you know, God's word is very clear, and it is the mind of our maker, and we have to follow that. But again, you're right, because what happens is so many decide that they don't want to be bound by that, or, well, they can't really mean that, because that just doesn't make me feel good about myself, and they decide to set up their own belief system. Now, it's not endemic, and that's really kind of, if you think about it, That's one of the ways Islam was created in the 700s AD, with Muhammad, and that was that it was a rejection of what we now consider Judeo-Christianity, and setting up a more shall we say harsh, more warlike domination of peoples under the term of religion. And that's the big difference between Islam and Christianity, Charles, is Christianity is a religion that says God loves you and wants you to be His, and Islam is a religion that says you must, you know, obey and do these things, and if not, then you are put under the sword and you're beheaded and you're killed or you're put into slavery. Because you have no option but to obey by force.
Okay, I think a quick way of putting that is it's legalism versus liberty under law.
Thank you. That's a much better summation of what I was just trying to say. Yes.
And you explained it, though. Sometimes when you speak in shorthand, people go, I don't understand that. You just explained it. So then we put it back in the soundbite term. But that's liberty. That's liberty under law. It's legalism versus liberty under law. And as we talked about with Mike O'Reilly on WLRY's Talk of the Town this morning in our monthly interview, the fact is that Islam is a legalistic faith. It's a legalistic faith. You cannot achieve heaven unless you obey the law here on earth. Christianity has some legalistic threads through it in certain sects. But the fact mm-hmm. is that Paul makes it very, very, very clear that you cannot achieve your own salvation through obedience to the law. In fact, he calls it a slave master. But he also calls it a schoolmaster. You can't know what sin is without the law. And you can't know that you need Jesus Christ without the law. Because as Paul says, if there was no law, there is no sin, which he's absolutely right. And basically what Paul's saying is that there is a fundamental, there is a basic, and there is a higher law that everyone is bound to obey. And when you don't obey it, you are in sin. And the difference between Islam and Christianity is we have an intercessor and a salvation that comes from Jesus Christ's sacrifice for our sin. He was the blood sacrifice that covers the sin. And without him, we have nothing. And that's where Islam fails. They do not have a savior figure. Muhammad is not a savior figure. He is merely a prophet. And as far as Islam is concerned, Jesus Christ is merely a prophet. Well, okay, that's fine. But a prophet of what? And as far as they're concerned, Jesus Christ was a prophet of the kind of legalism that they believe is the way to salvation. And this is how you get fanatical people strapping on bomb vests, and how you get people that will go in and allow themselves to be shot to pieces while murdering other people who refuse to come into the fold. Because as far as they're concerned, that is what's called being a martyr. What's committing murder in the name of the prophet? Barry, what's a martyr in Christian terms?
A martyr is a person who loses their life because they will stand on the gospel of Jesus Christ, and they will not recount or recant from following Christ, even if someone else threatens to kill them.
Yeah, so it is a 180-degree difference from the Islamic idea of a martyr. A martyr, the word martyr means witness. And someone who refuses to buckle under, even under threat of death, is a witness to Jesus Christ. And knowing full well that they are going to receive the reward for failing to deny Christ. Excellent. That's a good way of looking at it. What's a bad way of looking at it? Well, that you have to take out other people who don't agree with you in the name of Jesus Christ. There is no such thing, Barry. As we all know, there are times when you have to go to war. Let's be clear about that. I'm not preaching pacifism. There are times when you go to war, and that war includes occasionally killing someone who may not be in agreement with you on your faith. And sometimes it means going to war, sometimes because of your faith. There is a right to defend oneself. That is simply undeniable and simply part of the biblical ethic. War is an extension of the right of the individual to defend himself to a group of individuals who have gotten together and formed a state and want to defend the state. Now, what happens is you can lose your identity as a group. And the thing that usually holds a state together, and by state I don't mean like just Ohio. State literally means a separate country.
Mm-hmm.
But what I mean is you can lose your cohesion and identity as a state, and therefore your state will eventually cease to exist because those who do have a cultural identity will come in and change you if you allow it. And that's what's happening here. You know, this is why people are up in arms about unrestricted immigration, because you change the face of a culture by changing it, what constitutes it. And that's exactly what's happening in our country and has been for going on 50 years, Barry. We've been changing the ideological look of our country through immigration policy.
Right. And now we're getting ready to radically possibly change the complexion and view of our country through the Obama administration's broad open policy of accepting refugees from Syria. Now, you know, Chuck, I've heard the term Christian refugees from Syria, and that's great, but what we're finding out through what little bit of checking that they're doing right now, and with a large group of these Syrian refugees that have already entered at the port of New Orleans, is that there are very few who identify as Christians among them, that the vast majority of these Syrian refugees are of Muslim extraction. And funny thing, Chuck, when you start looking at photos and things of that nature, the very vast majority of these supposed refugees don't include any women and children. it seems to be mainly males of military age. And I think that raises a lot of concerns as well of what actually is in fact going on here. It's also raising to the point where you've had both, and I think as we recorded this on Thursday, today the United States House of Representatives is going to take up a measure, and we're going to talk about that here just shortly, about this refugee settlement issue. And the Ohio House of Representatives just took up a measure on Tuesday expressing the resolution and the will of the state legislature after a couple of days after the governor, John Kasich, and honestly, folks will probably wonder if their radios are not working, but I'm actually giving John Kasich some kudos here because Kasich actually stood up and said, you know, we don't want to have any more Syrian refugees coming into Ohio because there are places in Ohio that they believe that the Obama administration, through INS or through the Justice Department, are planning on, sending groups of these refugees in. Now, I think it was great. I think it was wonderful that he stood up, as many other governors have been doing. I think now there's like 28 states that have said, no, we don't want to accept the refugees because there is no security protocols and there has been no real vetting process. And so we don't know whether or not we're actually getting those who've been displaced because of warfare and because of ideological purging, or if we're getting sleeper agents who are in here to do harm to our country, as we've seen has done harm now in France and Nigeria, Britain, and other places. And I think that raises a legitimate level of concern there. Now, on the state side of it, Chuck, and we can go, and I want to go into this in a little bit more detail later, but I think that the governor and the legislature only kind of really did a halfway job on this because, as you know from living in that area, the larger issue is the incredibly large influx of refugees from Somalia, who by and large supposedly are Somali Christians, but as we're coming to find out, more and more the ratio is going wildly in favor of Somali Muslims that are coming in and immigrating into the Columbus area and in other major cities around the country. So, you know, this may be maybe more than just a Syrian issue. It could also be an issue with many of the new Somali refugees coming in.
Well, look, one of the problems that we're having here at least in this area, is that I have had testimony from people who work election volunteers who are telling me that Somalis are being brought in by the van load who cannot speak English to vote. And some people are convinced that they're being brought in multiple times under multiple names to vote, and they're being told how to vote by people who are supposedly translating for them. Barry, this is not how our system was designed to work.
No.
This is an absurd, but this is what happens when you bring in people who really don't want to assimilate into the American system. They want to set up and maintain a separate national identity in the United States. Now, you had some of these communities early on. You had communities. My uncle has a property in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and if you go into the VFW hall in Engadine, Michigan, there are signs in Finnish on the wall because a lot of Finns and a lot of Poles and a lot of Northern Europeans ended up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan for the reason that there was mining and there was forestry and there were all kinds of things that they knew how to do. So they went there. And they maintained their own communities for a long time. Western Michigan had, for a long time, had Dutch-speaking communities. I don't mind that so much. What I mind is people who completely don't want to mix with the American culture. And usually what you find is immigrants will come in and maintain their culture for a generation or two, and then the kids all want to assimilate into American culture and become part of American culture, which then absorbs some of the parts of their own culture, because they bring those things in. Or the reason we all rush out and buy a Christmas tree in December is because the Germans kept Christmas trees and would put lighted, this has always scared me to death, put lighted candles in the things as lights. My gosh, Barry, if you've ever seen a Christmas tree that's been cut for a couple of weeks and introduced the needles to a flame, you know why so many houses burn down at Christmas time. But that's one of the reasons that we have Santa Claus, is because that's a German tradition. Even though Santa Claus was Turkish or North African, depending on which one of the origin stories that you buy into. But this is one of those things that when people were setting up separate communities and, in fact, are coming actively to change the culture, I can tell you the Dutch and the Swedish and the Finns and the Germans did not come to the United States to actively change the culture. They came here to actively practice, usually, the practices they wanted to do without interference. That's a big difference in attitude, Barry, a great big difference in attitude. And immigration policy has been manipulated, so we are purposefully bringing in people who do want to change our culture, because the people who are manipulating the policy want to change our culture. They don't like American culture. They don't like Christian worldview. They don't like the whole idea of individual liberty. They like the idea of so-called collective liberty. This is why we're seeing the combination of a huge influx of immigration and the public schools going over to that form of thinking about these ideas.
Well, and that's true. And Chuck, let me just, if I could, give a quick example, because you mentioned Michigan, and that made me think about something that I'd seen just recently. And it's basically based around the elections. And I don't know, for many of our listeners, this may have not ever like really kind of crossed their radar screens, but it did come across ours, and it came across mine specifically, that during the elections back here about 10 days ago, 10, 12 days ago here in the country, with our fall elections in this off year, we had, for the first time, Charles, a city in the United States whose council is now a majority Muslim. It's the city of Hamtramck in Michigan. It is the first U.S. city council with now a majority Muslim representation, where those of Muslim belief hold four of the six city council seats now. As a matter of fact, you know, everybody talks about Dearborn and other places where there's a lot of unrest. You know, there's a lot of tension between Muslims and Native Americans. And I don't mean Native as in Indian American. I mean people who are who have been natively born in this country.
Natural born citizens,
exactly. So, you know, Dearborn has had a lot of focus, but really Hamtramck, which is a suburb of Detroit, has over 50% Muslim population now. It used to be a Polish ethnic enclave. But over the years, that has shifted, and many of these from Yemen and from Bangladesh and other places have come into this town of Hamtramck, to the point where back in 2004, as early as 2004, so 11 years ago, they had such a concentration in that city that the Muslim call to prayer was broadcast to the city every day, and has been since 2004. And so now what you have is, not only do you have that, and you have them being the majority of the population in an American city, but now the Islam, those of Islamic belief, are the majority on the council of Hamtramck, Michigan. Now, bravo for them that they want to get involved civically, right? However, you know, the situation is, Chuck, when the you don't have many other groups who migrate here, and you're right, it's the whole assimilation issue, assimilate into American culture, and whether they be, you know, of ethnic persuasions of one sort or the other, nationalities of one sort or the other, belief systems of one sort or the other, usually in the vast majority of circumstances, you know, they become Americanized citizens. It's really, in great respect, those of Islamic background who completely hold to, and the vast majority, and I know I don't want to paint too big of a stereotype because I'm sure there are some who do assimilate, but the vast majority who come into this country maintain all of their structures and belief systems, you know, including the Islamic centers, building mosques in the middle of cities, and, you know, I know the Columbus area's had some issues with that, of, you know, basically not assimilating to the culture they're in, but changing that culture to reflect and then become an Islamic culture.
Yeah, well, and that's been going on in places like Dearborn for a long time as well, even though Dearborn is not majority Islamic. It is, in this sense, the supposedly Christian residents of Dearborn are nominal Christians, if Christian at all. And I think you'll find that most of them would admit to not really following the faith at all. While very often the Arabs that come in are clinging to their religious beliefs, as one would expect someone who is among the faithful of any faith would actually hold to the tenets of their religion. The Arabs are holding to the tenets of their religion while the Christians are not, and therefore the Christians are making concessions to the Arabs who really want to bring elements of Sharia law into places like Dearborn and now Hamtramck. There are other places that have had a heavy Arab or sometimes Lebanese or Syrian population. Toledo has a large enclave of Syrians and Lebanese.
Mm-hmm.
And has had for decades because of auto manufacturing. People came here. Dearborn, if you're anybody who's not aware of it, Dearborn, Michigan is the home of the Henry Ford Museum, and that is the first Ford production line was in Dearborn. And if you ever have a chance to go up there, I would suggest you do so. But there are Ford plants all over the place up there, and people came up to work the auto industry. Well, that's completely understandable. And, people were welcomed here. Things may have been a little rough for them, but they were allowed to practice their faith. What they were not allowed to do was demand that Sharia law be adhered to or adopted. And now that's beginning to happen. This is what happens when you change the cultural face of a nation, as cultural percentages that are vastly different from the Christian perspective that founded these places, they begin to demand that their own cultural persuasions begin to hold sway. And that's what's going on in places like Hamtramck, Dearborn, even probably in Toledo. I'm not fully aware of that, but to some extent, I think that's happening there. I'm not saying that these are necessarily bad people. What they want is to their particular beliefs and viewpoints to hold sway in the areas where they live. And honestly, you can't argue with that. It's difficult to argue that within certain bounds that people who are gathered together in a community shouldn't have the self-determination to determine what their basis of law will be. That is exactly why you have to be very careful about opening your borders, and you have to carefully vet people who come into your country or into your state. And there's a real question, Barry, right now about whether states can actually restrict the placement of these refugees in the state.
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely right.
Because there is a constitutional provision that basically says, now I've heard it said that the really Congress can't do anything if the president gets to do what he wants on this, and I always laugh at that. The president simply is not a king, and he cannot determine these things on his own.
And I believe that the Constitution actually says that the power to set rules for immigration and naturalization is a power reserved to the Congress, not to the president.
Exactly. Here's the problem now, Barry. We have laws in place, and unless a law to restrict immigration passes now by a veto-proof majority, the president has stated openly that he will veto that legislation. So, in effect, he is in control because the borders are wide open, and they're wide open because Congress was asleep, and Congress is asleep because we were asleep when we elected them because we didn't ask them these questions. and the reason we didn't, because
most people didn't realize that this was a question that needed to be asked.
Exactly. And not only that, if you did ask those questions and there were people, they were immediately labeled racist.
Of course, because that's the Alinsky model, which is to deride and belittle your opponent personally so you don't ever have to address the logic or the wisdom of the content of their argument.
That's right. The core principle goes away. You basically go with an emotional argument, which is what we're trying to avoid on this immigration question.
Right.
You know, I really think that our borders should be open to accept Christian refugees, because Christian refugees are going to be closer to the American way of viewing liberty, and they're not going to be perfect. I mean, all you have to do is look inside the American Christian community and you'll see there are a heck of a lot of progressives in there who call themselves Christian and, in fact, are only Christian in the sense that they have someone named Jesus who they occasionally look at his teachings and sort of come up with something new, different, and exciting to go in the place of what he actually taught. Those of us who are actually believe that Jesus Christ was the Son of God and that he laid out his law and his way of salvation in his word, we're called fundamentalists. So, this is one of those things. There is a split in the Christian community. However, again, I would be more willing to accept Christian refugees who are being persecuted, truly are being persecuted. I want to know why all the Islamic refugees aren't going to places like Yemen and the United Arab Emirates and Kuwait and Saudi Arabia and all the countries that are willing to accept them. Why aren't they running there? Why are they running to Europe? And why are they running to the United States?
Well, because part of the idea of Islam is to go and take over a culture.
Yeah.
And let's just be quite honest with it. And Chuck, I want to just roll back for 2 seconds. That's what's happening in Hamtramck. There's an article in Breitbart by Pamela Geller, who is a very noted, outspoken critic of Muslim infiltration in the United States. And she's said that, you know, right at moments after the Muslims received the word that they had taken the majority on that city council, there was someone who had a cell phone with a video and had one of the organizers of the effort who was one of the winners saying, "Today we show the Polish and everybody else." You know, so basically already pushing that, okay, it is an us versus them mentality, and gaining control of the city council was specifically in keeping with the Muslim viewpoint about being able to control your environment. And Geller says it this way, you know, basically says, you know, that there was a reporter, a local reporter said, quote, how immigrants had dramatically changed the face and culture of the community, and said, now the Hamtramck City Council is going to reflect that diversity. And Geller says, what's diverse about a Muslim majority? Is there anything less diverse and more oppressive than Islamic law? What Muslim countries are diverse? Muslims won't even let Jews pray at the most holy of Jewish sites. Muslim countries under the Sharia subjugate their religious minorities. And I think that those are points I have to keep in mind, and it's shown up in other places. But, you know, I think this is going to be a laboratory in finding out, okay, are Muslims who come to America actually willing to assimilate, or are they here to supplant? And that's the kind of things that we have to look at. And I think this Hamtramck thing may show a significant, laboratory for finding out what the answer is before it's spread out to the rest of the country.
Well, okay.
Now, our problem is, you know, as we mentioned earlier, there is, you know, the House is going to vote on, you know, solving this problem with the Syrian refugees. The problem is, Chuck, is the bill that they're actually going to support versus the one that they should be supporting actually does very little, nothing to change the current situation. And as a matter of fact, is so weak that that one of the key chairmen in the House caucus refuses to support it because it frankly does nothing.
Well,
it's called the SAFE Act of 2015. It's House Resolution 4038, the Security Against Foreign Enemies Act, and it's being written up and sponsored by Homeland Security Committee Chairman Mike McCaul out of Texas. And that is the bill that new Speaker Paul Ryan is indicating that that's the one that they're going to vote on.
And unfortunately, you're talking about Bob Goodlatte, who...
Yes, I'm talking about Bob Goodlatte.
Well,
yes.
Bob Goodlatte has had his arm sufficiently twisted by the whip that he has switched positions on that bill.
Well, that's new because as of last night, he was going to be a vocal no on it, so... Obviously, either they were threatening his chairmanship or giving him something to get him on board with this, which is a shame because if that's the case, then it sounds like new Speaker Ryan may not be much different from a mold than old Speaker Boehner.
And basically, that was also on Breitbart. I'm not seeing it at the moment. That means it's fallen off the front page. But basically, Bob Goodlatte had fallen into line and was going to support the not Babin's bill, but McCaul's bill, which is the SAFE Act, the Do Nothing bill.
Right. Basically, that's a bill that basically really doesn't change anything, but says it requires that the Secretary of Homeland Security, the Director of the FBI, and the Director of National Intelligence personally have to certify before admitting any Syrian or Iraqi refugee into the U.S. that the individual doesn't represent a security threat. Okay, well, that's all great and well, Charles, but what you're basically saying is of the tens of thousands of refugees that are pouring across here, that we... While they're pouring in, these three individuals, and of course, in their apparatuses that they operate in the administration, will have to personally certify that these individuals aren't a security threat. So that does two things. Number one, frankly, since these three officials are appointed by Barack Obama, if Obama says we're going to let them in, do you think that they're going to buck the president who gave them their jobs and can take them out of their jobs? I don't think so. Secondly, though, if something does happen and it turns out that the ones that they vetted were a security threat, who gets the blame and the censure and loses their job and possibly comes up on criminal charges? It's not Barack Obama,
no.
The leader of the administration. It's these three firebreaks that this bill would put in place. So if I were the Secretary of Homeland Security, the Director of the FBI, and the Director of National Intelligence, I would be lobbying Congress not to pass the SAFE Act because basically it's putting their jobs and potentially their freedom on the line.
Barry, this is kind of a joke because if you think about it, you know, there was an old thing during the Clinton administration now 20-odd years ago a couple of very smart comedians would do the this is Bill Clinton thing, and they would say, you know, Harry Truman had the famous sign on his desk that said the buck stops here. Well, they'd have Bill Clinton saying, well, the buck never got here. Well, Barack Obama is basically taking that a step further and saying the buck is not allowed to come here.
Right.
This would be a case where he would slough all responsibility off on his underlings, who would be doing the mass of vetting of these. Look, you cannot personally vouch for hundreds of thousands of people. It cannot be done. You do that with a decree. That's why this bill, this SAFE Act, is meaningless. No one will ever pay the price. And in the end, someone will look back and say, boy, we really made a mistake on that. We really should have looked at that a little more differently. Now's the time to say, no, what's going to happen in the future? But Barry, we live in a culture now that doesn't think about the consequences down the road. We think about the immediate consequences. What'll happen now? Am I safe now? Am I going to have food now? Am I going to be able to buy gasoline now? Okay. That's fine. You pass a law that has an immediate effect, but it has a long-term effect down the road. That's exactly how we got in this immigration mess. The immigration mess that we have now was caused in large part by a law that was passed in the mid-1960s that set quotas for immigration that basically kind of squeezed out European immigrants in favor of Asian and African immigrants. It closed out Australians in favor of Asian and African immigrants. It allowed the large importation of Central Americans, you know, the large influx of Central Americans. So, you know, there are all kinds of stuff that was passed in the 60s. Let's talk about Medicare. One of the reasons we have a healthcare crisis is because of Medicare. When was it passed? In the mid-1960s. Again, during this period of upheaval, right, or just before the period of upheaval in our culture. So, Barry, we have to start being cognizant about the long-term effects of these bills. We can't stop. We can't keep thinking in terms of how does it affect me now. You have to think in terms of how's it going to affect my kids? How's it going to affect my grandkids? Let me tell you something. Right now, what we're doing with immigration law is going to have a major effect on your children and your grandchildren and your great-grandchildren. There are some of us who, you know, we can see what's coming, and we're sounding the warning bell. And the problem is, Barry, that we also live in a youth culture. And in a youth culture, people who have life experience and have seen these things before and know, have a pretty good idea of what's going to happen, are ignored. Because after all, that's old, that's antique. Things don't work that way anymore. No, things, there is nothing new under the sun. This is why you rever people who are older and wiser in your culture. Older doesn't necessarily mean wiser, but you do seek out people who have some wisdom, who have some insight into what's going on. And what has gone on in the past and how history may be attempting to repeat itself, and you pay them some heed. I learned that a long time ago.
True.
Basically, is the culture changing? Yes. Is it changing for the good? No, it's not. There are a lot of things in our culture that needed to change. We needed to change the racism picture. We needed to change a lot of things in the way classism and that kind of thing. Yes, I agree. Those things need to change. But you know what? The other things that we changed at the same time aren't working out very well.
No, that's true. Now, it's interesting you say that, Chuck, because that kind of like leads right into on Tuesday, the House of Representatives in Ohio voted on a bill, House Concurrent Resolution 31, and it was basically a bill to urge the president to halt the settlement of these Syrian refugees in Ohio and the United States. Okay, so it's a resolution. It just states the sense of the legislature, correct? It was amazing. I was there in the gallery on Tuesday because we were also dealing with another bill regarding defunding Planned Parenthood in part. But as I'm sitting there in the gallery, first and foremost, as when they brought this resolution up, the Democrats asked for a recess for a caucus, and they disappeared off the floor, all except for a couple of them, Representatives Bill Patman and Representative John Barnes. they disappeared probably for at least 10 to 15 minutes. The speaker comes back to the dais and resets, you know, because that's what he told him he'd give him. He goes and resets for this to have the discussion and the debate on the bill or the resolution. Many of the members of the Republican Party got up to express why they thought it was a good idea and things. Still, there were none of the Democrats were in their seats again. And I started thinking maybe it was they were holding a walkout protest. Well, finally, they come back, drifting back in one at a time to pick up their microphones and Charles, to begin a debate or their version of this, basically saying, oh, there's nothing will change with these immigrants coming in. It will, you know, there's nothing wrong. There's nothing to fear. You're just being fearful. You know, you're being, you know, basically xenophobic, things of that nature. Chuck, it was an amazing obtuseness on the part of an entire caucus of representatives of the people of the state of Ohio, with those two exceptions that I mentioned earlier, who actually voted for the resolution. All the Democrats except those two voted against it, to basically hear their argumentation and sit there and wonder, are you living in the same world that the rest of us are living in? As we have just had the bombings in Paris, the terrorist bombings in Paris, the Beirut bombings now, and, you know, and after that, yesterday we had bombings in Nigeria. You know, and none of these bombing, you know, Russian planes that have been downed by bombs that are now being, you know, noted as being from ISIS terrorists. We're seeing this all over the place. I would hope that, you know, we don't have time for it here on the program, but I believe when we put this link up on our website, we can link to the video from the legislative session that day. And I think maybe we can actually maybe, like, you know, keep that down to the clip of the debate over this particular resolution. I think our listeners, if you go to our website at principledpolicy.com here in a few days, we will put that up. You need to hear what certain individuals in the Democratic caucus think about this particular issue, Chuck. They don't get it that it's a worldview issue. They don't get it that it is not a, you know, we're just all going to get along type issue, that it is a worldview that states you must submit and follow our belief system or die or be enslaved, versus a belief in a worldview that basically says that you are loved and that God wants the best for you. So I think it's very instructive, and I hope our listeners will go over to the website and they will take a look at that. But it kind of makes me cringe a little bit as we talked about the votes here last week on the state issues, that we basically have now handed over much power to a party that is in the minority and has been for a while now, who have shown once again why their way of thinking and their philosophy isn't the majority position in the state of Ohio.
Well, Barry, as we've talked about on this show many, many, many times, the Democrat members of the House, the ones that voted for this against this bill, are attempting to operate from a position of neutrality. In other words, a secular neutrality. Barry, what's the first thing we learn when we learn presuppositional apologetics and we learn how to think in a true Christian worldview? There is no such thing as neutrality. There is no neutrality.
Such thing as neutrality.
That's right. And any attempt to maintain a neutrality essentially ends up with something rushing in to fill the vacuum that you've created.
Absolutely.
And in this case, Islam is attempting to rush in and fill the vacuum left by a secular society. Now, that's what's happening in France. France has been a secular nation since 1789. Basically, the Catholic Church was dethroned, if you will, in France, and a secular viewpoint holds sway. And now things have been attempting to rush into the vacuum for all kinds of strange things have rushed into the vacuum, all kinds of strange philosophies. You'll find that a lot of existentialism is French. That's an attempt to fill the God-shaped vacuum that's in that society. Well, we're out of time for this week.
Okay.
I'm going to ask everybody to go to our website, www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. And we would ask that you join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.